Okay, welcome. It's very good to check the Twitter feed because the Twitter feed tells me that I have technical problems. It's okay, yeah. Some people overtweet, I would call it. Okay, so welcome. I get the big room and it's what an honor. My name is Johannes, that's me, and Pedo Bear. And I'm part of Monochrome. And Monochrome is an art tech philosophy collective from Vienna. And today I want to talk about, first of all, I'm here at SIGINT 2010. I'm very proud to be here with you. And today I want to talk about guerrilla communication. And guerrilla communication is a very interesting and important subject, I guess, especially for hackers. And it's about the absurdities of power, I would call it. So let's play with them. Welcome, fellow hackers. And you can see here is the short description that I wrote. And it's on the SIGINT homepage. And I think it even was printed somewhere. But I'm pretty sure most of you haven't read it at all. There's one really important line in it, and I want to emphasize that, so I made it visible for you. Information and political education are completely useless if nobody wants to listen, and that's the main problem we have nowadays. So, you are all aware of that there will be a test later on, so write the stuff down in your papers. Information and political education are completely useless if nobody wants to listen. But you have to listen right now because you're sitting here, and that's good. So write it down in your papers, and you will need it in your jobs as well. So you're not only learning for SIGINT here, but for life. Good. You're all part of the so-called info-worker semi-elite. You're all working with information, and you all like that. That's why you call yourself hackers. And as you will know, because that's your terrain, that's your medium, you are all with me living in a wonderful age, and it's called the age of communication. Communication is a wonderful thing, especially if it's global communication. Communication. Global communication is organized and institutionalized by big machines that we call, the media. Media is a word for lots of things that we need to communicate. Communication is a wonderful thing, and there has always been media, like our faces and our hands. But I mean, I like my hands. I use my hands a lot for communication. You will notice that. But in the recent years, or let's say in the recent centuries, there is a new thing around, and it's media enabling us to communicate over long distances. So even behind the hill there. So there were a long time in history we didn't communicate with anything behind the hill. Nowadays, we are pretty much doing that all the time. So what's behind the hill? Behind the hill, there are long distances. There is a world out there, and there is an interesting reality out there. We are now, it is reality, even if it's under quote, it's reality. Our reality, so to say, our houses and our streets and our towns and our habits is supplemented by faraway realities of faraway houses and faraway streets and faraway towns and faraway habits. On MySpace or Facebook, we can have friends that might not even exist, and still we keep befriending them and feel great about it. For example, myself, I have like around 12 or 13 fake Facebook characters, and one of them is a female girl who's part of the Aryan white supremacist movement in Montana. It's pretty good to be such a character from time to time, so try it yourself. As a result, our world has become bigger, and smaller at the same time. This worldwide world is no longer a world constituted by direct action in the way that, say, our garden is by our gardening efforts. Gardening the modern world means gardening the media. The garden we live in is a media garden in which we act and react. Every real world problem has to be represented in the media system to be real, or at least to be real to us. Even if something might finally kill us, like, I don't know, global warming or whatever, the media has to tell us now that some such thing might happen in some such future, whatever, so at least we shouldn't act surprised while we are croaking and dying. We all know, and most of us probably understand, that the major power of today's world is the media. Whoever controls the media controls everything. And since the media is not nature, but culture, Western culture that is, it is always owned by somebody, like that guy. He's owning the computer here. There is no such thing, and I think I will repeat that on and on and on, there is no such thing as free media. What's the problem with free media, and why there is no such thing as free media, I can easily demonstrate you. Where is it? There is. There it is. There's my iPhone, okay? It's my medium. No, you can't have it. I will call the police. He tried to steal my medium. Why? Because I paid for it. Lots of money and free blah, 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 whatever. Media, as long as we cannot download our iPhone, is never free. We can, of course, we can have something like blogs. We can have something like the so-called freedom of information. But as long as all the tools that we use to access these free media, there is nothing like a free medium, because all that stuff is being created somewhere in China and people are exploited to create that thing for us. So as long as we cannot print our own iPhone, please start working on that, there is no such thing as free media. Okay, media is always owned by someone, and some liberals like say, no, there is something like the free media. We have something like indie media and blah, blah, blah. But still, if you cut the deep sea cable going from America to the European Union, then we'll see who owns the deep sea cable, where is the freedom of information. We are all, it's all based on privatized infrastructure, like Google. I mean, we search the world through Google, and Google is a profit-oriented company. There's no such thing as free media. That guy, it wasn't even free media back then. That's David Fine. He's a good friend of mine. And I asked David Fine in his lunch break to prove to myself, to make a statistic, that 25% of all media belong to Bill Gates. So I told him, I will pay you $20 if you make a statistic for me that proves that Bill Gates owns 25% of all media. We were actually thinking of maybe 35% or 45%, but then we said, 35% sounds good. So I paid him $20, and that's his statistics. Okay, proof. Well, so now we understand as the strongest. Yeah, that's him. It's like the gates of perception. Good. Media is always owned by someone, and it's the strongest political, economic, and heuristic power in the modern world. And most of us do not own significant parts of media. I mean, I have my iPhone, you have your Android, whatever, okay? You own tiny little bits of it, and most of the time, you're not able to construct it yourself. Good. It's a little bit stupid, but what can we do? So if someone wants to do anything about changing the system, you have to hack the system. And I know that you're pretty interested in hacking the systems, A, because you're hackers, and B, you're probably stupid marketing guys waiting to have a clever idea for your next stupid marketing concept, like this plastic house or whatever you want to sell. Okay, so there is a process out there called communication guerrilla, or guerrilla communication, and I'm about to tell you what it is and how it works, and how we can help ourselves hacking the world or creating new stupid marketing concepts for stupid products. Well, dumbass me. Good. I also know that you don't want to change the world because, generally speaking, you're living on the sunny side of the world. We're most of us here living in Germany or the Western world. There are no people here from Bangladesh or India or China or wherever we are talking about here. So interestingly, communication guerrilla is always a topic in the Western liberal society, but nobody is actually talking about guerrilla communication in Bangladesh. They have other problems, but that doesn't mean that we can help people in Bangladesh or wherever with guerrilla communication acts. Let's face it. Okay, so first of all, A, I think many people should go to hell, but B, I think that hell doesn't exist, which is a little bit of a shame because I would like to see them in hell, and it would be a really nice place to have Rupert Murdoch there or whoever else. But what could we do? They are lucky bastards. They will never go to hell. They'll just die. Guerrilla communication intends to wage war on the media system, and it intends to wage war on reality that is produced by this system, or even like meta system. So at the moment, we can't talk about the media system. There are media systems of media systems and overlaying media systems who interact and crossfade and whatever. So the problem is that if we talk about hacking the system, we first have to understand the system, and the system is pretty tricky. Good. Using the word guerrilla suggests that there's a war going on, yes, and it suggests that media tries to constitute and preserve the status quo. And that's pretty much right. This is the status quo of a society in which knowledge and information are not only means of controlling people, as many liberal people might fervently acclaim, but also to segregate people into classes, like the working class and the networking class. And we all pretty much hear the networking class. The networking class is something pretty interesting because it's also about privileges. Working class people and networking class people have one thing in, like, there's a difference. It's like the knowledge of networking. So still we live in a society that is constituted around classes. We have the poor, the rich, and the more or less rich, that's we. And some people don't like that they don't wanna pay taxes or whatever. But still, we have classes, we have a sex problem here, we'll have a discussion tomorrow about feminism and hackers, and we're of course talking about race. And whatever we try to do, there's always, even if you think that there is nothing like a class-structured society nowadays, there is. If you just go around the corner and buy a donut, you'll see there is a class-structured society out there. And of course, birthplace, that's really important nowadays. So what can be done about it? How can we fight these powers which also make sure you can keep your privileges as the ruling power elite? So the problem is we pretty much have to attack ourselves. We have to open up. We have to stop wanking as hackers and spreading information. It's not about this interesting idea of like, I know more than you. It's about working together. So let's see what classic guerrilla communication suggests. The determining factor of guerrilla tactics is to launch small but effective operations to attack an enemy which is much bigger but also a little lame due to a certain degree of formal, let's call it institutionalization. Now I have it. Good. Hacking language here. Good. So the problem is most of the media systems are pretty big, but if you see that something like the ZDF or PBS, they're pretty strict, they're pretty hierarchically organized, and most of the time it's actually easy to attack these structures because they're easy to understand, let's call them. I'm not talking about the media system in specific, but certain players in the media system are easier to understand than other players in the media system. So, there are tactics, and the tactics of guerrilla communication are taken from classical guerrilla warfare, and the difference between a military or paramilitary guerrilla and guerrilla communication strategy and communication guerrilla strategy is that the latter is not aimed at just overthrowing its enemy or destroying its enemy or to put the foot on its face and itself in its place. No, that almost sounds like a Dr. Seuss poem, but no. Guerrilla communication does not want to defeat mainstream media. Guerrilla communication is not about like destroying media. It's, because that's not possible, it doesn't want to exert like, let's call it capital punishment or genocide or suppression or whichever classic male military intentions there might be else, although the term stems from that military background. I suspect that all you info workers out there might like that because it's anti-militaristic, but we'll see. There's a reason that many people are very keen to learn about guerrilla communication, to retrieve it to their small, smelly offices and office boxes, to Google and wherever else, to Nike to make a new communication guerrilla strategy to selling sneakers and using graffiti or whatever. So there are many, many people interested in guerrilla communication. Most of them are working for advertisement companies and are not interested in political change. So what can we do? There is economic success out there, but you will definitely not end up with a lot of economic success if you're in guerrilla communication. Let's see. There might be mobbing communication, which is a certain subform of guerrilla communication, but I'm not talking about that right now. And really, there is one book out there who describes guerrilla communication tactics in mobbing and anti-mobbing practices for American corporations. It's very crazy. Good. But we're not talking about that. There is military guerrilla and guerrilla communication, and both of them, although I'm talking about guerrilla communication here, they try to interfere in the monologue of bourgeois mainstream media. Like the real, the military guerrilla is very much interested in the media themselves, because if you see the history of warfare, especially in Vietnam and warfares in the last 3 or 4 decades, there was lots of guerrilla communication and media guerrilla communication out there, like distributing leaflets and comics on Vietnamese soil, so they would do whatever. So there's lots of media use in guerrilla communication. And the way that the US military is choosing different journalists and where they are, and embedded journalism itself is actually a form of media guerrilla communication, but it's on the wrong side of the whole spectrum. So. Good. Reality and normality are created by having control over the media and publicity and public spaces. It is inspired by various theories on social communication, how it works, and how it works for those in power. It includes positions that tend to focus merely on the government and exclude any other factors from the analysis, feeling no need for showing a more complex portrait of social powers. But guerrilla communication theories might also include more left-wing or Marxist positions, pointing out that all power is derived from the social factors underlying and forming a society, such as class, race, and sex. My position in this would, of course, be that normality and reality are created within such a structure. And to attack normality and to attack reality would also mean to attack the very structure of society, something which theorists have referred to as the semiotics of reality or social semiotics. In a media-based society, and of course there's no such thing as a non-media-based society consisting of more than one person, we have to deal with signs and significance, and that's very important. You can tweet that, it's short enough for tweeting. The meanings and habits and conventions of speaking and thinking, the images and stereotypes which control everything, that's what we are talking about. It's what is represented and how it is represented, and of course, what is not represented and how it lacks representation. It's not so much about Rupert Murdoch. I hate Rupert Murdoch, he is an asshole, but his assholeness that I will not dispute is not a leading factor. The problem is we should not attack people like Rupert Murdoch. We should not attack people like Bush, because there's a systematic reason why those people are up there. But running around on the streets and crying, Bush is an asshole, Rupert Murdoch is an asshole, won't change anything. Most of the people already know that. Okay, we are talking here about changing the cultural grammar, I would call it. Society and culture itself has certain rules, and these rules are called cultural grammar. And we have to hack into the very foundation of cultural grammar and change it. And if we think as, like in a very postmodern term of like society as a text, we can reformat and copy-paste texts in society and change the cultural grammar. Meanings are negotiated in this cultural grammar. Good and evil, very important. And good and evil are determined in this kind of thing. We might think that the bear is actually a nice bear, but who knows? Maybe he wants to wank or something. Or his cousin, the pedo bear, is waiting around the corner. Who knows? Okay, so good and evil are determined, and bourgeois morale is defined as the morale of the ruling elite and then forced upon everybody else through bourgeois jurisdiction and prisons, locking away those who won't comply to their position in the social class, race, sex structure. And of course, this structure is not a free-gliding and mythical pattern, but merely the effect of class and race and gender management in society. Guerrilla communication tries to understand the processes by which the media come up with social frameworks of behavior and perception. And by understanding what's going on here, it also tries to introduce tiny symbolic changes to that system in order to make people suspicious of the information, wanting to understand the ideological structure and goal it transports. Guerrilla communication urges us to reconsider what we believe and also what we believe to believe and whom we do believe and why. Moreover, it tries to point out that media is forcing Gleichschaltung, and that's one of the really, really great German words I will not want to miss. Gleichschaltung, alignment. Okay, and I'm not talking about bullshit like 9/11 was an inside job, Gleichschaltung or stuff like that. So we're not talking about conspiracy theories here, okay? Conspiracy theories most of the time are reactionary and end up that the Jews are like to blame or something, yeah? We're talking here about a very, very complex structure of interacting systems, and not about that CIA is controlling the world. They are not controlling the world. They are stupid people in stupid offices doing a stupid, boring job. Okay. There's something out there. It's called Gleichschaltung, and it tells us that information and the media should be free. Maybe one should mention Wikipedia in this Wikipedia in this this context. Wikipedia is an interesting thing of hacking the world, because there are people out there who play the biggest massive multiplayer game in the history, and they're actually thinking that they are writing a new encyclopedia. But at the same time, they're just battling each other. It's about winning, and it's not about information. That's an interesting thing. Not even the people at Wikipedia are interested in information. They're interested in fucking each other up. So not even Wikipedia will help us in the freedom of information here. So in that term, fuck with Wikipedia. Please do so very hard, okay? Fist them, okay? Okay. Free media in a capitalist, bourgeois, liberal society is something very specific. A free good, like see, a free good nowadays might be a nice gadget, a simple freebie, a marketing tool for something else, or merely a paradox. But there's nothing like a free product or a free good out there. Even if I'm friendly to my friend, it's actually about social capital and how I can like help with that. I'm exaggerating, of course, in a certain way. But don't be tricked into the freedom, even of open source. There is no freedom in open source. It's a reputation system, and people fuck each other up. Fuck with it very hard. Fisting, even in open source communities. Okay, good. So if you disagree, feel free to write it in your tweets or blogs or whatever. But I think I might be right or not. I don't know. The freedom of information, you know. There's a wide range of strategies guerrilla communication could use. Most of them have something to do with mocking and mimicry of official communication, with faking and rearranging it in its process. It's in the process. These strategies are useful in attacking a single player like a multinational corporation doing very wrong by trying to stain the image of the corporation and tactically embarrass him as a warning to stop the evil doing. While this rather useful strategy is pointing out the power of the public as buyers and consumers, or not buyers or not consumers, it still remains within the construct of, like, there is good and thoughtful capitalism and there is bad capitalism, yeah? But the problem is, capitalism doesn't really care about if it's good or bad. It's just like a system, it's working. There is no morale implanted in a capitalist system. There is no morale in capitalism. It's just like, it's a way that our world is structured on a very economic process. And there is no politics in that. They are using politics, but okay. So there's no good and bad capitalism. So how can we attack and whom should we attack? Let's see. It makes sense. It's a kind of like a half-assed kind of thing. Of course I like the yes men, and of course I like that they fuck around with Dow chemicals. But still, I mean, we have to ask us the question if the yes men are not actually helping Dow Chemical when they attack them. I don't know. We have to find out maybe later. Okay. Another strategy would be decoding information. I like it. I found it on Google. Good. So ICANN has cheeseburger, of course. Yeah. So what do we have here? What problems do we face? So of course we can change meanings, and of course we can try to implant stuff into the media system, but do we actually realize how it ends up there? So can we actually control guerrilla communication acts, or is it just like the postmodern dice that we just have to do and wait to see what happens later on? Okay. Another strategy would be decoding information techniques and processes themselves. It's a very theoretical process, but let's see. The idea is that publicity means to expose yourself and therefore you can be attacked. If you do something on the marketplace of the media, of course, the same way you can be attacked. Advertisement has to be placed somewhere in the public, and as soon as something tries to give instructions to you, so if someone tries to sell you a product, you can obey the message or you can disobey the message. But you're always like caught in this problem of that you're dealing with the advertisement. So you see the advertisement and then you can say, no, I will not buy that product, but at the same time, you're wasting your life thinking of not buying it. We are still playing by their rules. That's what I'm saying. By not playing by the rules, what do I mean? That's what we're doing with Monochrome. We're trying to experiment with that. I don't have a clear answer to that, but I'm just posing questions here, and maybe I can help you later on. You could, for example, decide to not buy a specific product any longer, yes. This might be your personal and individual strategy of guerrilla communication, but it sucks because, unfortunately, it's always the best products which are advertised because they are advertised. There's no such thing as free individual taste, that's what I'm saying, but advertisement wants you to believe in the freedom and in the individuality of your taste, which doesn't exist, and I can prove that empirically. We are caught in this like endless loop, in this feedback loop of fighting something and at the same time stabilizing the system. You too can, of course, sabotage instructions by misinterpreting them and acting dumb. That goes like, I see like factory owners, for example, who of course are not here at this Congress because they have to work in factories, and after they work in factories, they're pretty tired, so they don't go to hacker conferences. But I mean, you're white collar supremacists, so you are here. Why not use the CD drive in your office computer as a coffee cup holder? Just use it in a way you should not use it. Use your systems and your networks in a way they should not be used. Delete stuff by accident. I mean, it can happen. You can delete stuff. It's just happened. I mean, you're human. You're stupid. You can delete stuff. I mean, nobody knows that you deleted it on purpose. And just delete a couple of things. It doesn't mean, you know, you won't get fired just for deleting a subfolder somewhere. I don't know. Maybe. But that's your job. You have to find out. And that's also guerrilla communication. It's communicating, you know. It's a certain form of sabotage. But let's face it. That's what guerrilla communication should be. Okay. It's got a tinge of freedom, let's say it. It's represented by this horse. Let's see. You could be this horse if you delete subfolders on your servers. You could be this horse. You could even be a unicorn if you like, or an anal porn unicorn, whatever, but whatever you like, just do it and think that it's good, okay? So it's freedom of something that exists beyond the mere functionality the way it was intended. That's what I'm saying. You can misuse your tools to create communication interferences. Anyways, one of the basic strategies has to be faking things. I mentioned that already, but it's important. Press releases by political parties or companies, like you could actually send out a fake press release of the Pirate Party. It would be quite interesting to see if like a party that doesn't really even exist for such a long time suddenly has fake press releases. That would be kind of cool. Or like the Yes Men. The Yes Men are actually pretty cool, and at the same time, some of the stuff they're doing I don't like. Okay, let's talk a bit. The Yes Men, they're one of the most famous guerrilla communication groups of all times. And one of the biggest things they did is that they created fake homepages, for example, for Dow Chemicals. And on this homepage, they propagated that Dow Chemicals would, after 20 years, finally pay billions and billions of dollars to the people in Bhopal. Because Union Carbide destroyed many, many lives there in the 1980s. And Dow Chemical like bought Union Carbide, so they kind of inherited this like tragic legacy. And the Yes Men made a fake corporate social responsibility site for Dow Chemical, and they propagated that they really want to pay money now for the people in India, in Bhopal. And they ended up, yeah, Thou Shall Be Liable. That's one of the early 1990s posters that were out there. And what happened is that the Yes Men ended up on BBC Live, and this guy working for the Yes Men, he was proclaiming that the Dow Chemical would now pay the money. Of course, they did not pay the money, but in a certain way, the Yes Men improved the life of Dow Chemical and actually cost them lots of money because they had to send out a press release that is, of course, a fake, and then the stock market had a little bit of a problem with that, and whatever. So it's about representation. At the same time, the Yes Men are representing Dow Chemical, and many people who saw that online, probably millions of people, were probably thinking, wow, Dow Chemical, they're paying $20 billion for the people in India. That's actually kind of cool. And most of them never ever got the press release of Dow Chemical saying, no, we actually didn't. So you can see, of course, it's a good hack of the media system. But what did it do? Some people out there think that Dow Chemical is a pretty cool corporation. And who wants that? I don't know. So the basic idea is, like, how can we use strategies that are immune to irony to a certain way, because irony never works good in a big media system, especially with big players like Dow Chemicals. I don't know. It's about representation, it's about identity, and it's about alienation. That that are the three main factors of guerrilla communication and what we should try to spread and attack, of course. So identification and over-identification are two really important tags here for your tech cloud. To identify with something and to over-identify with something is what the Yasmin did here. They over-identified with Dow Chemicals and tried to use that. And if that worked or didn't work, who knows? Because you don't have like a scale in guerrilla communication to say this thing worked better than this thing. It's just you try to feed stuff into the system and try to see what happens. Okay, so at least through over-identification, which means that you use affirmation to a degree that goes far beyond what is conventional in order to show what something really means, let's say it that way. But also to act out the habits and conventions of your enemy. Guerrilla information, for example, uses classic marketing tools and knowledge in exactly the same way it is always used, but twists it in the opposite direction. This works for print releases and interviews as well for personal habits like what you wear and how you look like. The yes men, you can see them here, for example, are masters of the typical company spokesman body language and tone of voice. So what they do can no longer be called a parody. So they're not making a parody of corporate guys. No, it's more like an impersonization. It's almost like they're like the Elvises, the fake Elvises of the corporate world. You could call this strategy the illegitimate occupying of speaking positions in a world in which some people and players have more power to speak and a louder voice than others. So from this perspective, the yes men, of course, are entitled to speak for Bhopal and speak for the people in India and use their way or their artistic form to spread the message. Still, we can discuss if that's useful or not. While classic counterculture media could hardly ever have such an effect on the public due to its natural limitations, hijacking or faking the channels and speaking positions means to get messages out with a lot more power and urge. So you could say that guerrilla communication is not trying to destroy the dominant codes, but rather to deconstruct and strategically abuse them. And of course, to use them for its own purposes. Now we understand that guerrilla communication doesn't have a military goal like destroying or overtaking anything or suppressing and overruling anybody or exterminating a special group of people or whatever. It's more about bringing a special group of people like the people of Bhopal on the map of global consciousness. If that works or not, we can discuss, but it's the tactics. Most of the time, guerrilla communicationists are not so much concerned about themselves, but I'm also sure that media attention for themselves as well as possibly as a possibility of upgrading their human capital as ethical rebels and skillful pranksters adds a lot of motivation. I mean, the yes men are pretty much like global players in the media and art market now, and they even end up on Hustler. Why are the yes men on Hustler? And why is subversion nowadays like an official strategy you can use to be famous? I don't know. It works that way. It works that way because we live in a neoliberal society. We live in a society that's not a disciplinary society, but a society of control. And in the meantime, society itself wants us to be subversive. Society in a Western society wants us to be liberal and crazy and live out our dreams. And at the same time, they are fucking us in the ass. That's the problem. And to a certain extent, they're also fucking with me and the yes men. And sometimes I like it. Okay. To sum up, guerrilla communication is a versatile practice of cultural resistance. The earliest forms of modern guerrilla communication are to be found within the art scene of the between and after the First World War, when a group of international artists and deserters met in Zurich on neutral Swiss ground to launch the Dada movement. I'm pretty sure you have heard about the Dada movement because especially in the German feuilleton, the people always use Dada if they describe art. The stupid journalists don't understand. So it's all like oh, it's Dadaist. It's Dadaist, so we don't have to deal with it. Oh, it's Dadaist. Okay, so Dada was a precursor of modern and postmodern radical art movements such as the Situationist International, the punk movement, or Neoism. A major concern of Dadaist art was to cut in on old forms of artistic activities such as painting pictures or writing lyrics. Instead, they were looking for new forms of art to fit into the modern world. They started out as noisemongers, with pretty radical performances, but soon they began to manipulate the press by distributing fake press information. And in a way, Dadaists worked with the media like other artists worked with paint or metal for sculptures. They also cut and recut pictures, words, and lines from newspapers and assembled collages and montages out of it, sometimes of grotesque and sometimes of political content. Later on, they launched interventions in the public space, attacking major institutions of the post-war society. The so-called Oberdada, the chief Dada, Johannes Bader, one of the first performance artists of the 20th century, managed to confuse the attendance of a church service at the Berlin Cathedral by reading out his own bizarre sermon. So he pretty much like went there and held a sermon, but he was not a priest. And people were kind of confused about what he read there. And still, well, it's in a church. It must be official, whatever. Yeah. So he also threw leaflets entitled The Green Corpse, Die Grüne Leiche, down the gallery at the German National Assembly. By doing that, he catapulted Dada right into the bourgeois media because they reported about the whole stuff. These interventions broke ground for a lot of late modernist art and subcultural strategies attempting to model the public space or the social space rather than holding on to classic art stuff such as painting pictures or sculpturing. A vast group of social dropouts emerged during the high times of Western counterculture, from the beatniks here to the punk, to the punk movement. And these people developed strategies to provoke and challenge society to implement their their political agenda into the public space and to start reclaiming the streets, just like a slogan has it. The street is synonymous for public space and the humdrum surface of society. Therefore, it was considered the perfect stage for informing people, or let's say for counter-informing people. Most activists came from a classical art or journalist background, but had experience that nobody really listens when you speak in a traditional art space. Your average guy, that's a pretty average guy, I have to say, does not go to exhibitions. He does not go to concerts, nor does he get in touch with counterculture media. Counterculture and the art world are niche places. I mean, you see, they're not 70,000 people here. They're like 50 people here, okay? We are in a niche market here, yeah? So art is just art for most of the people. Well, it's another art piece, whatever. Just art. Don't pay attention to it. Art is a special task and a special place for very special people. And that means most of the people out there do not get affected by art. Like that. What the fuck? I want to see Jackass. I don't know. But in a certain way, it's right, because Jackass is by far more artsy than most art things. But especially if you consider it and compare it to the Viennese actionists of the 60s and 70s, most of the stuff Jackass are doing is by far more obscure and obscene than the Viennese actionists ever did. But, well, they make actually money with it. Okay. So art is a special task and a special place for special people. And it's something for the elite. And it is involved with the elite by the elite is buying its high-priced products of criticism. That's an interesting thing. Most of the people out there who buy art buy it because they know that it's like attacking society, but at the same time they're buying it. This is the classical drama of bourgeois art in a bourgeois society. Same is true for bourgeois journalists, if you're any journalists out there. It simply keeps embodying the same old role as a critical sidekick of the powers to be. Journalists, of course, are attacking politicians. They are criticizing society, they're criticizing people, but at the same time, they're actually stabilizing the system. They're like hackers who find bugs in systems to fix the bug. That's, in a certain way, what journalists are doing. That means, especially societies where there is lots of free media, lots of free media and free press, like the United States of America. There's like, you can say and do whatever you like, but at the same time, it's a very stable system. And attacking the system is part of the system. So it's about the shiny good cop and the bad evil cop. The evil cop is the one with the penis here. It does a good shoe-shining job within a system that neither opposes nor represses them. I mean, I'm not talking about Iran or something like that. But I'm talking about who is really oppressing journalists here. Some journalists might be oppressed, but it might actually be part of their strategy of becoming famous. Good. But generously grants art and literature and journalism this special, you can feel free and well-fed kind of feeling, whatever. Okay. So, people would, of course, complain if there would be a lack of freedom of information and lack of freedom of journalism, but at the same time, you know what I told you. Around the 1960s, and that's pretty important, a lot of strategies emerged to confront the man and woman in the street, right where they were, to escape the bourgeois art world's limitations, and of course, the bourgeois journalists' limitations. They were doing things out there where the people were. The first happenings were staged referring to Dada, and a lot of street theater groups popped up everywhere. Street theater ranged from conventional plays acted out amidst the shoppers and passers-by to role plays where the audience didn't even realize they were watching a play. That's Vali Export, by the way, and she actually let people on the street in Vienna touch her breasts, as it's like really interesting feminist street art performance. And the post-bourgeois artists were trying to bring the art back to the people, not as a handy service as it is to the bourgeois elite art consumer and art buyer, but as a form of irritation. This was one of the many starting points of guerrilla communication as we know it nowadays, and also of the so-called Reclaim the Street movement, which includes funny yet irritating activities like flash mobs, I think you know that guy, or the Adbusters movement. To adbust means to bust and destroy advertisements and other inscriptions in the public space and to epitomize the vulgar capitalist idea that there's no such thing as a public space, but only private spaces belonging to those who buy or rent them. Everybody pretty much is an adbuster, so even if you don't want to get arrested, you can adbust, at least sometimes, because everybody has busted advertisements in his life before. For example, there's a billboard here, and you can simply park your car in front of it. It's a very low-key form of guerrilla communication, but it is. I'm just saying, yeah? Or you can have, like, your dog pee on it or something. It's fine. If the internet is a public space too, and of course the internet is a public space, it's a public living space, actually, you can block your pop-ups, for example, if there are still, I mean, there are not too many pop-ups left, but you could still block them. The possibilities are endless, that's what I'm saying. So there's a great variety of ad-busting techniques, and only a small percentage might get you into serious trouble with the law. More severe interventions include pasting over advertisements, tearing them off, graffitiing on them, or otherwise commenting on them, rendering them impossible, changing the message, or the like. These are not necessarily very refined ways of attacking the ads, but rather spontaneous expressions of disgust and frustration with advertisement in general, or a specific ad, one displaying, for example, a racist or sexist image. If you take into account that the average person receives up to 3,000 advertising messages every day, well, you kind of understand that there's a certain threshold of aggression and frustration out there, and the need to let steam off, at least from time to time. In the 1970s, counterculture split into two traditional, wings, a more traditional Marxist wing consisting of small parties and groups that wasted a lot of their precious time and beautiful youth fighting each other. I'm so happy that I wasn't a communist in Germany in the 70s. It would really have ruined my life. And of course, there was something like Spaßguerilla. And Spaßguerilla is something very interesting, fun guerrilla. Fun guerrilla was one of the many movements about trying to do crazy and interesting things on the streets, or like the Sponti movement. And these movements were emphasizing on the spontaneous and site-specific character of their action, of their actions, and plenty of the activities which were conceived at that time, like throwing pies, like cakes, at celebrities, are still around in the guerrilla communication movement of today. They too started working with so-called fakes, fake information and actions distributed by the bourgeois media, oblivion of the fact it was spreading a hoax. A popular slogan had it that the basic idea was to invent false facts in order to create real events. Die Erfindung falscher Tatsachen zur Schaffung wahrer Ereignisse. But they too made real object fakes and did cultural piracy stuff like pirate editions of the socialist classics or handing out well-faked subway tickets. That's really cool. Pirate radio stations like the famous Radio Alice in Italy appeared and hijacked radio frequencies. Graffiti was an important weapon of that movement to override the text of the city. And in its best and most far out moment, they came up with the postmodern idea that social structures are texts too, and therefore can be overridden in the same way you can override an advertisement on a billboard. At the same time, the squatters movement emerged, and you might not know that, but we have hackerspaces nowadays because of the squatters movement, because most of the early hackspaces in the Netherlands, for example, they were part of squats. So we have hackspaces now because there were squats in the early and mid-1980s. There were many, many people there doing interesting things. I would call them, in general, post-bourgeois artists, even if they didn't consider themselves artists. But they were, in a very literal sense of the word, attacking actual private property as well as non-material cultural property. So the good thing that guerrilla communication is that, unlike everybody else, it shows no respect to the fact that the media and the public space are always owned and in the hands of the bourgeois elite and semi-elite. They never actually cared for that, in a certain way that many people nowadays don't care about copyright. And I think that's one of the main reasons why it will fail. As are the images and cultural frameworks we live in. And its central and basic strategy is to misappropriate images, words, radio frequencies, and shift them to different contexts. In France, the influential situationist movement defined a form of art called détournement. It means that you roam aimlessly around the streets of Paris or Austin or whatever and take what you find and then do something with it. So they were actually trying to form something like a new psychogeography of the city, like walking around, for example, with maps of London in Paris and trying to find the subway entrances or whatever. So very interesting, absurdist things. But in a certain way, I mean, yes, what is reality? A lot of these strategies were and are still strictly illegal, some of them not. Therefore, guerrilla communication activists had to develop forms of camouflage and hiding away behind multiple names and open pseudonyms, like in the Luther Blissett project. In the meantime, a detective novel bestseller was published under the name, plus lots of other books and readers on the matter of cultural subversion and jamming. For example, the German guerrilla communication group, Autonome Afrika-Gruppe, and they published their book about guerrilla communication under the pseudonym of Luther Blissett. Of course, Luther Blissett doesn't exist, but there are so many people out there who use Luther Blissett as their pseudonym, and they write texts under the name of Luther Blissett, that you almost can hide in a cloud of Luther Blissetts, and you never ever know who really wrote the text. Pseudonyms don't just grant invisibility for people avoiding the blame. It also lets you get away with violating the bourgeois principle of identity as a person, as an artist, or as an author. The person is, so they say, a nation within the nation, and Staat im Staat. And that is why some people try to overcome it by forming collective personae. Because if you attack your own personality and your own status as an author, you're, of course, also attacking the system itself. The Luther Blissett activists demanded everyone to edit their works exclusively under the name of Luther Blissett, and many, many people helped and are still helping. So in a certain way, guerrilla communication is also a lot like hacking. And hacking is, of course, one of the means of guerrilla communication, because it is a hostile assault from outside the system trying to find a way into the system. Of course, there is no outside the system of like the capitalist system, but there's always like an outside of a certain radio station or whatever. So that's the system I'm talking here, not the general system, okay? To change or manipulate it from within. And to do so, you have got to know how everything works. So first you need to understand the way in which the media shapes and constitutes reality, just like hackers know what a website is and how a website works and what DNS or whatever is, yeah? And that is to say, not simply what a website looks like and how you can find it on an ocean of other websites, but also how to know how the code works. If you know how the code works and if you know how the code of the media works, you have a fair advantage, and that's good. Actually, you've got to dig deep into the code to then be able to manipulate it. And it's not easy to manipulate the code, but who says that stuff has to be easy? Every one of you will probably know what like programming language is or whatever. So you'll get an idea of that we can actually attack the foundations of society works, because society, that's what I'm talking about, like cultural grammar. It could also be called cultural code. And some people actually might sound better for hackers to call it cultural code than cultural grammar. Okay, whatever. So, but the question is, do we really understand how the system works? Do we really know what we want to change? Because that's the main problem. Do we really think that white males living in suburbia should rule the planet, and it's their power that is shaping society? Of course not. It's just the nature of the capitalist system that there's a constant flow going on, and this flow is pretty stable nowadays, but we can try to divert the flow. But to divert the flow, you have to know where to divert it to. Most hackers are pretty lame. They're good in the technical code and the technical activity of hacking into servers. For example, in the 80s and 90s, there were a couple of attacks on the Pentagon, and then they put, of course, when they hacked the Pentagon website, they didn't put any interesting stuff on the website. No, they put porn pictures on it. Well, how lame can that be, like putting a porn picture on the Pentagon homepage? I mean, of course, it's kind of funny, but it's interesting that so many people have the knowledge to do stuff and at the same time don't actually know why they're doing it except of like doing it. And that's a little bit boring. So I think there might be more interesting things out there that we could achieve together. Even people who are not in the knowledge of like technical structures. Okay, so to hack into the media changes its message flow, and we want, of course, to attack the stereotypes it communicates. How is the racist and sexist and classist subconsciousness of the liberal society shaped through there's a typo, but it's good. Like let's attack writing itself. The media and access to it. So many people want to change society, but they don't know what's the best way. I mean, I don't want to end up people who think that 9/11 was an inside job to change society, because that would end up in a Holocaust. Good. What can we do? So first of all, we have to be clear that before you want to change society and before you want to change something, you have to deal with yourself and your surrounding and what you actually want to do with your life, okay? That means some people actually, it might be good for them to read Foucault or get into theory or do something beyond the mere realms of making a funny joke somewhere on the internet or cracking a homepage and whatever, yeah? So I think before you actually want to create disturbances, you should be a little bit considerate about why you want to do that. There are many people out there, you can have like, there are many suggestions out there why you would be interested in doing that, yeah? But, I mean, there are people out there, let's see. Yeah, of course, everybody's looking at you. It's the ultimate goal. No. You have to change the political economics of society, I say, yeah? And the problem is we're all working around in circles if we are not thinking of what we are doing. Just doing something, well, I don't know. There are people out there who try to look back in the mirror, and that's really important to do that. So just like doing communication guerrilla acts without actually dealing with the history of communication guerrilla might be funny, but it might not bring us anywhere, okay? We have to start somewhere, but we can actually create like an avalanche here, but nobody knows where the avalanche is going and what the avalanche will do. There are people like this guy here. He was part of the Sponti movement, and he was really interested in changing society and blah, 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 and he ended up being Joschka Fischer, okay? And he fucked up a lot later on, yeah? So it's almost like a meditation thing, like, before you try to hack the media, try to do a little bit of thinking and meditating, okay? What else can I say to you is, don't end up in the system, although there might be a big chance that you end up in the system, but whatever, you know. Don't always head for success, at least if you want to head for success in this way. So please do me a favor and at least erase all information I gave you from your memory right now. That might be not sharing might be the ultimate, the utmost communication guerrilla act. Who knows? It's a nice little angel or fairy or whatever. And that's the picture I want to give to you right now. Look at the fairy and all these nice Hello Kitties out there. It looks nice, but she actually wants to rip your head off, okay? So no questions, thanks a lot. My name is Johannes. That's my email address for people who still use email. And of course, I have a Twitter account. It was a pleasure talking to you. And if you hate me, go out and hate me. Thanks a lot.